Hi everyone, and welcome to Narratives of Purpose podcast, a place where we discuss how ordinary people are making extraordinary social impact. My name is Claire Marie Gandhi, and I am your host on this show. On today's episode, my guest is Emilie Alirol. Emilie is Associate Director at the Medicines for Malaria Venture based out in Geneva. Today we will speak about clinical science, antimicrobial research, and neglected tropical diseases. As you can see, it's a healthcare-related conversation, and I'm very excited to share this discussion with you. Hi, Emilie. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me today. It's great to have you on the show. So first things first, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. The sun is up in the sky. It's a very nice day, so everything is all right.
Great, perfect. Now let me start with a few words of introduction on your background. So you are a biologist. You studied at the University of Geneva. You hold a PhD in cell biology. You also have a Master of Science in epidemiology from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. You started your career after your PhD in clinical research at the University Hospital of Geneva, and you also worked at Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières in French. Then you joined the GARDP, which stands for Global Antibiotics R&D Partnership, as project leader. You worked there for a few years until very recently, just a couple of months, that you have a new position as Associate Director at the Medicines for Malaria Venture. So we obviously know each other from our studies, because I'm also a biologist, and I recall visiting you for a few days, I think it was in the summer of 2004, in the northern Italy, in Padova, where you were doing your PhD. And I have to say, I was really amazed and impressed by all the activities that you were doing and the hard work and dedication that you are putting in your studies. I wanted to know, what brought you to focus on HIV research, neglected tropical diseases, from the very beginning of your career?
So I guess the answer is to be found in my childhood. I had somehow a different childhood, although, you know, today maybe it's not that unusual for some people. But I was born in France, but very quickly I left France with my parents and went to live in several countries that are classified as low and middle income countries. So I spent part of my childhood in Peru, in Senegal, and in Nepal. And very early in childhood, I became aware that I was actually born in, you know, on the right side of the fence. I was pretty lucky to be born in a European family with good socioeconomic status. And living in those countries, I quickly realized that a lot of people didn't have the same luck as I had. And this notion that globally there are wide disparities among people, among, you know, children and other populations, was something that accompanied me since then. It's true that when I grew up and started my studies, I became very interested in life science. I'm still fascinated by life, its multitude of forms, and in particular by pathogens. Viruses, bacteria, and parasites are very simple forms of life, yet they can bog down entire societies, as we're currently experiencing with COVID-19. So I was fascinated by those very simple forms of life and how, you know, they could affect human beings and yield to diseases. It became quite obvious after, during my studies, during my PhD, that I wanted to find a job where I could contribute to improving the faith of populations in LMICs, just to give back a little bit what I had the chance to receive. So, for me, working on NTDs, on infectious diseases, on HIV, enabled me to, at the same time, satisfy that aim, that will I had to make a difference for the most deprived populations, but also it coincided, it fitted well with my interest for pathogens. So that is where, I started to look for opportunities in HIV in particular, and also other diseases that primarily affect neglected populations.
That's really fascinating and really interesting. Can you just precise? You mentioned infectious diseases, HIV, and NTDs. What are NTDs exactly?
So, neglected tropical diseases, NTDs, are a group of 17 diseases that encompass a variety of pathogens. They are prevailing in tropical and subtropical areas, and their burden is huge. According to the latest global burden of disease study, about 1 billion people globally are affected by them. And so they encompass diseases caused by viruses, by bacteria, and by parasites. And they're found, mostly in resource-poor settings.
I have to ask you this. I've been intrigued, or I would say a bit wondering about the term neglected. Can you tell me why they're called neglected diseases?
Well, historically, they were called neglected diseases because they were not the subject of great attention, be it from the research community or from policymakers and people involved in setting priorities for health interventions. And they were oftentimes put at the very last position in the priority lists when investment in health was to be considered.
So one of these diseases is Ebola. And while I was reading through your profile, I saw that you mentioned something about the outbreak that took place in 2014. You wrote that during this Ebola outbreak, you advised MSF, so Doctors Without Borders, on matters of research ethics and implementing clinical trials. How did you come to develop expertise in ethics?
Well, as I started my career in NTDs and HIV, as I mentioned before, my main drive was really to address unmet needs and address, in particular, needs of neglected populations. That entailed working in settings where there were very few health infrastructures, very limited resources. And that came with a number of challenges, in particular when it came to ensuring that research ethics was respected, that scientific rigor was respected. So, very early after I've had joined the Geneva University Hospital, I volunteered to become a member of an ethics committee. First, I joined the Ethics Committee of Internal Medicine at Geneva University Hospital. And then a couple of years later, I joined the WHO Ethics Research Committee. And that committee oversees all the research that is supported or funded by WHO globally. And that is where I learned a lot about the key principles that have to be respected when conducting research in vulnerable populations. So I stayed with the WHO ERC for about 6 years, including 3 as a vice chair. And this is where I gained, insight into research ethics. And that is what probably positioned me quite well at MSF to advise on how to do research in Western Africa during the 2014 Ebola epidemic.
Wow, that's quite an impressive track record. I mean, being vice chair of the World Health Organization Ethics Research Committee, that's really impressive. And you did earn your place as being an advisor to MSF during the Ebola outbreak. Now, let me just touch upon another point that I'd like to have your opinion on. I also have a bit of background on ethics and running trials, but my experience is more about running trials, I would say, in the Western countries, or rather more in Europe. So from your experience, what is the fundamental difference, or the fundamental differences, I would say, between running a trial in West Africa for Ebola and, let's say, running a trial on osteoporosis in Switzerland? I know it's quite an extreme example, but just to have your take on that.
There are a number of differences. The two that come to mind are the following. The first is the vulnerability of the population. So oftentimes people affected by neglected tropical diseases or by diseases such as Ebola are much more vulnerable due to their economic situation, but also they might not have the same education levels as populations in rich countries. And that creates the need to protect them even more from research misconduct in particular. So their ability to consent to studies, to understand the complexity of what is being investigated, and their ability to make a truly informed decision to be part of a trial is something that needs to be really evaluated carefully. The other aspect that is fundamentally different is that clinical trials conducted in Western countries often, I mean, happen in within a health system that is pretty strong, with, you know, good quality of care, access to health insurance and the like. So patients that are that participate in clinical trials also have an alternative that is a good alternative. If they don't want to be in the studies, well, they will still receive care, they will still have access to medicines and the like. In resource-poor settings, it's much more difficult. And so there is also a risk when you conduct trials in such situations that you actually create undue incentives for participation. So those are two aspects that are mm-hmm. fundamentally different. But there are many others.
Yes, absolutely. Very insightful indeed. Now, moving a bit further into your career, I previously mentioned that you were part of the GARDP or GARDP. What is the purpose of this organization?
So GARDP is a joint initiative between WHO and DNDi, the Drugs for Neglected Disease Initiative. It was created in 2016 and was incubated for a couple of years by DNDi. The initial idea behind GARDP is to create an organization that focuses on developing new treatments for infections where antimicrobial resistance has become a serious concern. And GARDP adopts a model that is similar to other product development partnerships, such as DNDi and MMV. This model is based on very strong partnership with pharmaceutical companies, but also public actors, so NGOs, academic organizations, and other international organizations. The idea is to leverage public funding to be able to develop treatments for indications that are traditionally not commercially interesting for private actors. And so GARDP has partnered with several pharmaceutical companies, mainly small biotech companies, to be able to develop new antibiotics where, you know, the need is arising due to drug resistance.
And what was your role exactly as project leader?
I was leading the sexually transmitted infections programs, which is a program focusing on drug-resistant gonorrhea. We had one new chemical entity that was the primary focus of the program, which we developed in partnership with Entasis Therapeutics. It was a very, and it is still a very promising drug candidate. But the SDI program also looked at other antibiotics that could be either repurposed or further developed, with the idea that STIs in the community are treated syndromically. They are treated oftentimes without knowing what pathogen is causing them. So it was a very, very interesting and very a much needed program, because gonorrhea is really nowadays causing a lot of concerns in terms of drug resistance. And the current treatment is going to become, you know, useless in a few years' time.
So you just mentioned drug resistance becoming increasingly a major concern. And it's true, this is something that, at least for now, in terms of awareness, is not really front and center. I mean, not everybody is really aware of that. But as you said, it's going to be really increasingly an issue globally. So this is really real. What's happening there?
Yeah, it is real. And I mean, AMR affects all countries globally, but definitely the impact on poor population is greatest. And there's been a lot of research around, you know, how AMR actually contributes also to poverty in those diseases. In the countries that are affected, it is true that we don't talk much about AMR, although it has come up in the global health agenda over the last few years. It is indeed a very, very difficult problem to tackle, because we still have, you know, antibiotics that work. Thanks God. The main issue is that the market for antibiotics is completely broken. It's dominated by generics. Antibiotics are oftentimes very cheap. Antibiotics are used for a number of indications. So volumes of sales are very, very high. And so for any new drug entering the market, it is very, very difficult to compete with those existing products. And the reality is that as AMR is progressing steeply and constantly, there's a need to find new treatments if we want to anticipate the situation where, you know, the current tools won't work. And as you know, developing new drugs takes a lot of time.
And now that we are all facing this pandemic, you know, with COVID-19, do you think that the fact that the focus right now is on this specific virus, that this will either increase awareness about all these infectious diseases, as you mentioned before, you know, parasites, bacteria, viruses, and so on, to a much broader extent? Or on the opposite, this might actually push back these other diseases, which are still present in terms of awareness.
It is definitely true that what is happening with COVID has a lot of similarities with what could happen if AMR, you know, progressed. And we see that, you know, already in some instances. There are infections that can no longer be treated. If you think about neonatal sepsis, for instance, in some countries, a very large proportion of the infections have become resistant to the first-line antibiotics. So the reality is very similar. This untreatable disease notion is clearly, something that that we're experiencing with COVID, but is certainly true for some bacterial infections. So there's a point to be made, there's a parallel to be made. However, the ability of public and private investors and funders to invest in AMR is really a question mark today. There's an enormous amount of funding that is now focusing on COVID and addressing the pandemic. You probably learned about the ACT accelerator, and I believe WHO estimated that $38 billion will be necessary to fund the ACT accelerator. All that money may be, diverge from other health problems, including AMR. I also think that countries will have to address the economic crisis that will follow the COVID pandemic, and the amount of funds that will be available for AMR research in the future will also depend on countries' ability to first tackle the economic consequences of the pandemic.
All right, let me just pause here and rewind a little bit. You mentioned two terms. I just want to make sure that our listeners fully understand what those were. So you spoke about neonatal sepsis. Can you just explain exactly what that is, what condition that is? And then you talked about this ACT. Please expand a bit on that.
Neonatal sepsis is a condition that affects neonates in their very first days and weeks of life. It can be caused by a variety of pathogens, a variety of bacteria, and some of those bacteria, such as Acetobacter baumannii, have become resistant to most antibiotics used so far. And there are studies in India and other LMICs that show that the current first-line antibiotics that are recommended by WHO are no longer working, and that the bacteria are resistant to those antibiotics. It is believed that neonatal sepsis now is one of the prime contributors to neonatal mortality, and that in order to be able to achieve significant improvement in neonatal mortality, neonatal sepsis has to be tackled and new treatments have to be found. Now, the ACT Accelerator is a global initiative that aims at developing tools to address COVID pandemic. There are three components. One is on vaccine, another one is on diagnostics, and the last is on treatment. A number of countries have recently announced that they would contribute to the ACT accelerator and fund part of the research and development activities that need to take place to find these new tools. However, I just read yesterday that we are very far from the commitment that is expected. I mean, 38 billion is certainly a very, very high figure.
Yes, absolutely. 38 billion is quite a high figure. Indeed, I agree. You just addressed vaccines there, and I'd like to jump on the opportunity that you're currently working at Medicines for Malaria Venture and ask you this. I was reading about a project last year, a clinical trial, which is run right now in three African countries, namely Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. And it's a pilot project on a malaria vaccine, and it's a trial run in children up to age 2 years old. So do you know about this project, and can you tell me how it's been going on so far?
It's not my primary area of expertise, but from what I know, the existing vaccines focus on Plasmodium falciparum and not the other species that can also cause malaria. Those vaccines have been tested extensively in Africa, in particular among children, and they have received a marketing authorization. However, the protection that they achieve is not very high. So control of malaria and elimination of malaria cannot rely exclusively on those tools. And definitely other approaches have to be followed, including use of bed nets and prevention of infections through bed nets and spraying, but also treatment of dormant forms of malaria, and in particular those caused by Plasmodium vivax.
So you're sharing a lot of valuable insights here, and I'm really learning a lot. Thank you so much for that, Emily. Now, looking forward, in terms of public health and the future of public health, how do you see this area evolving from your perspective, from your expertise, which is more research-based?
I believe, those tools that are developed by the private sectors do not entirely address the medical needs of our societies. The R&D efforts driven by pharmaceutical companies has largely focused on diseases that could bring some return on investment. But we see today, and that is not only the reality in LMICs, but it has become the reality also in rich countries with AMR and COVID, there's a need for other actors to step in and to develop these new tools. Definitely, in my opinion, treatments, diagnostics, and vaccines should be considered common goods. And there's an urgent need to reset the whole system and how, we as societies develop the innovations that are required for everyone to have access to care, to proper care. So the organizations such as MMV, such as GARDP, DNDi, and FIND have really demonstrated that it is possible to develop new medicines, new diagnostics that address those medical needs. And I do believe that the future is really in those type of entities that address needs that may have not, been addressed by private companies.
So, do you see more and more collaboration taking place between the pharmaceutical companies, basically the private sector, and these entities that you just mentioned?
I hope that funding is gonna increase for those entities, because you know that developing new treatments and new diagnostics is extremely costly. Clinical trials are not cheap, so the investments that are required to develop those new tools are significant. And without proper funding by philanthropic organizations or by public money is really required.
I fully agree with you. Funding is really key, and moving forward, it will continue to be key as well. Still looking forward now, what would be your advice to young people who say, I'm really eager to pursue a career in life science and more specifically in clinical research? From your standpoint, what would you advise them?
I believe that people who have an interest in clinical research or in public health very early on should pursue that interest. It's very rewarding. From my perspective, and I can only talk about myself, what is absolutely key is to be able to stick to my values. And that is what actually I enjoy in my work, is that I've always put patients and unmet medical need at the center of my professional choices. As an individual, it matters a lot for me to do something every day in my life that can actually contribute to a greater benefit. And my advice to young people is really to never lose sight of their values and what is their driver, because this is where you achieve, you know, the best. This is where you develop what is the most important, in my opinion.
Well, I have to say, those are really wise words and great pieces of advice. Thank you. We are unfortunately reaching to the end of our conversation, but before we part, I would like to ask you a few short questions, a bit more personal, not necessarily related to what you are doing right now. And you can choose, basically, between either book or music. So let's get started. First question, what are you listening to nonstop these days? Or what is the book that you are reading right now?
Listening to Mélodie Gardot, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's a very old song that was written in the 30s. Mélodie Gardot's interpretation is really nice. So, yeah.
All right, second question. Do you have a song, an artist, or a band that particularly resonated with you at a specific time in your life?
When I was doing my PhD and when I was studying in Padova in northern Italy, I listened a lot to Radiohead. That's one of my favorite bands. And if I look back to this year's, you know, studying at university, are really associated with the Radiohead.
Third and final question, what is your all-time favorite album or book you absolutely recommend?
My all-time favorite book is from Nicolas Bouvier, it's L'usage du monde. It's a wonderful book. It's actually that book that gave me the flavor for travels and for meeting people in different places with different cultures and different ways of looking at the world.
I have to say, it is a great book. I read it twice, so it's also one of my favorites. I will make sure that all this information is available on the podcast page so that listeners can go back and check the book and the music that you just told us about. Emily, thank you so very much for taking the time to discuss with me today. It has been a great pleasure catching up with you after such a long time. Final question before I let you go. What can I wish you for the future?
Well, I guess to be able to always be present for others and for myself. You know, I'm getting older and turning the 40 years old crisis milestone. Pay attention to the moment that you are presently living. Pay attention to the people around you and not be, you know, dragged into either your past or your future. So, yeah.
Well, then I wish you to be more present in the future. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you so much, Claire.
That was episode 2, a conversation with Emily Aliron. Emily is truly a great person, open and generous, an inspiring professional attached to her core values. Thank you so much for tuning in today and listening to the episode. I really appreciate you taking the time. You'll find all relevant information on this episode on the podcast page. Here is a reference. narratives-of-purpose.podcastpage.io. Until the next episode, take care of yourselves, stay well, and stay inspired.